It is 6 o'clock and it is the first Thursday of the month, and that means it is time once again for the Post Prison Education Program radio show. And we are joined here live in the KODX studios this evening by Ari Cohn and Catherine Kusick, and both with the Post Prison Education Program. So, Ari, you want to take it away?
Thanks, Mike. Hello. I started this program 15 years ago and have shied away, I think out of cowardice, really, from talking about sex crimes and people who previously committed sex crimes because it is such an emotional topic with everybody. That I think it's impossible or very seldom that you can have a conversation about that subject. But a guy walked in our office the other day, maybe last Saturday, I forget, but within the last week, and he did 11 years in prison. And he's been out for 10 years since then, and he's a very successful iron worker, and he's a super hardworking guy, and he's living a really miserable life for something that happened more than 20 years ago. And it just got me thinking that we should address this. So tonight what I want to do is spend about 20 minutes talking about sex crimes and people with a history of having committed sex crimes, and then 20 minutes talking about one Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation anecdote, and then the final 20 minutes talking about another Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation anecdote. I think I should talk about the misconception that people have about who prisoners are. It was interesting. In the last 10 days, we've gotten $78,075 have come into the program. And I made a list of those donations one at a time. So there's 50,000 from a Googler, 10,000 from a Googler, 5,000 from a relative of a former student of ours, and then 75 from somebody at Microsoft, and 250 for somebody who works at the Federal Defender's Office, and 10,000 from another Googler who used to give stock and this time gave cash, which was wonderful. 1,000 from a guy that has been to prison with us many times. 250 from somebody I don't know. 1,000 from a PhD microeconomist at Amazon, who, and 500 from another Googler, and then 250 from a guy who's been with the Department of Corrections for 30 plus years in a high management position. And the common thread amongst these people that donate so much money is that of the $78,075, $77,000 is from people who've been to prison and taken the time to meet prisoners. And Mike and Catherine both know this because they're both in the office a lot. They've both been to prison with us. Mike, how many times have you been to prison? You just keep recidivating. You keep going back and you go back and you go back.
Your program is not helping me. I've been to prison three times now because of you.
We haven't taught you right. It's like we took Catherine, wasn't she? Never went back. But you keep going back. But the common thread is I don't know what the percentage is, but the common thread is $77,000 and out of the 78,000, $75 in the last 10 days has been people who've gotten up close and personal and met prisoners and former prisoners and discovered their humanity and discovered that the Seattle Times and all this mainstream media and Blethyn Incorporated, as I call them, it's like half-truths and lies and false reporting. And I found an email that I want to read, and then we'll start talking more specifics. But years ago, we had on our board of directors a woman named Lori Guilfoyle, and she used to work for United Way. And she was a community impact manager with United Way, and I kept bugging her to go to prison with us. And I used to, her office was right across the street. United Way's right across the street from where we were for 14 years in the central building. And so she would be in our office like multiple times a week, 5 o'clock quitting time. She'd pop in, she'd talk to students and applicants and staff, and she helped read applications. And so we saw a lot of her, but we took her out to Aberdeen, to the men's prison at Aberdeen. And we had that day, we had about, I think it was 274 guys in the visit room with us for 3 hours. And, you know, you both know when we're in the prison, we're right there in the midst. And we're surrounded by prisoners and we're,
it feels like a different world. Yeah. That's what you're focused on. You're not out in the real world.
Yeah. And you're just, but you're like up close and personal, and there's never any fear that you realize you're talking to human beings. But the weird thing that happened with Lori was after that trip, she just disappeared. And it started freaking me out. And because for about a week, we didn't hear from her. She didn't pop in the office. And I'm thinking, like, you know, something went wrong, which we've never had anything go wrong. But I'm thinking something went wrong. You know, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, we got this email, which I'm going to read. Really hard to read. So she said, "I have been pretty quiet since our visit last week. I have a group of really good friends that I go out for drinks with every Friday after work. Last week, I couldn't go, just didn't feel right. I talked to my mom a couple times a week. She lives in Oklahoma. I haven't called her. Saturday, I just got in the car and went for a drive out to Mount Rainier. Every time I talk about it, I cry. Every time I think about the men I met, I cry. Every time I think about Becky, Vance, Dolphy, or Pollard, I cry. I cry in my car, at my desk, as I'm working out in the garden. I thought I was okay about people honoring and respecting all people for who they are. But until last week, I don't think I really understood what it means to honor and respect all people for who they are. I have so much to learn, and I thank you, deeply thank you, for giving me the opportunities you have given me." So that's, you know, I just want, I read that because I want you to know that the people we've got locked up, regardless of their crime, if they committed a murder 25 years ago, if they broke in your house because they're addicted or mentally ill or both and stole your electronics so they could pawn them, if they committed a sex crime, there's a story behind that, and they're human beings. To get to the topic of sex crimes, I came up as a conservative. I came up in a very conservative family in Central Florida, redneck Republican Central Florida, citrus and cattle country. And And I sort of had those values when I started this program in 2005. So, and I thought at the time, I didn't even think about it. We had been helping people with sex crimes before I realized we were, because we don't focus at all on what somebody, we're looking at the future. We're future envisioning. We're not looking at the past. And so we don't focus on what the crime is that caused people to go to prison. And we don't even ask it on the application. But at some point, I had it in my head that maybe 2 or 3% of Washington's prisoners are people who previously committed a sex crime. And then quite some years ago, I saw on a Department of Corrections fact card that it was close to 20%. And I was going to say in today's radio show that it was 19%, because the last time I looked at the Department of Corrections data section on their website, which actually is pretty comprehensive, by the way, it was 19%. But I looked this afternoon, it's 21%. So this is a steadily growing group of people, and that's now past more than one in five. And we better pay attention to what's going on, because it's a reality. When it got real for us was in 2007. We were 2 years old, and a woman named Margaret Peggy Kellow, K-E-L-L-O-W, who was employed at the time by the district court, the federal court, Western District of Washington. And she was the person who supervised the sex offender unit for the federal court. And I don't even know how she got my name. We didn't even know we existed in 2007. But, you know, it's kind of like when Google found us in 2009. We're like, we didn't even know we existed, but somehow people were starting to know. But she wanted to know, and she was pretty pushy about it. She wanted to know if we had a policy about people about people who committed sex crimes applying to our program. You know, did we penalize them because of the crime or not? And it was really clear that this woman wanted us to not be handling those applications any different than we would anybody else. And so at the time, Sonal Abraham, who's a lawyer with the feds now, was on our board, and his wife, Brenda, worked in the unit at the Defender Association that full-time defended people with sex crimes. And out of ignorance, we just turned the board of directors over to Sonal and asked him to educate us and help us develop the policy that the federal court, was demanding that we have. And so we went through quite a few meetings, and then we came up with a policy, and I'm going to just read it to you. This was the motion to our board. It was moved, the post-prison education program will not disqualify any individual based on their status as a registered sex offender for participation in the post-prison education program. The motion was seconded and passed unanimously. We've adhered to that all these years. So I kind of want to talk about, you know, there's all these misconceptions that the public has about what sex crimes are committed, who commits them, what happens, how it happens. And I want to really quickly, and it's going to take me, we're going to go past our 20 minutes for this segment.
Oh, that's fine.
We're at 6:15 already. But I want to tell you about my learning experience. So it's sort of a Barry Goldwater. Not now. My politics are, I always say, to the left of Che Guevara. But when I started this program on this subject, people who committed sex crimes, I was pretty Republican, you know, conservative, Central Florida, cattle country, citrus, redneck, hater, closed-minded Republican, and wasn't sympathetic at all or open-minded at all. And then this is what happened that really kicked off my learning experience and changed my belief system dramatically. So I used to live in Wedgewood, and I had one of the bedrooms was an office. So and I had a fax machine there. And one day I was working from home instead of the office, and the fax machine started going. And I still have this fax. If anybody wants to come by, they can read it. And it just started out to be the longest fax in the history of the world. It just kept going and going and going. And I'm like, what in the heck is going on? And finally, it was a 23-page fax, and it was from a graduate of our program. And the short version was her older, when she went to prison for a meth case. And when she went to prison, her husband and their kids were free on the streets, right? And the husband got a girlfriend, and so she had her children, and her kids were with her husband as she's in prison. And her oldest son forced anal intercourse on the girlfriend's youngest daughter twice. And what the facts was about, and I should just tell you, you can't talk about a lot of things without being specific, and I'm not, as you just saw or heard, I'm not going to use euphemisms or whatever. We'll just call it what it is. So the facts was, it took DSH CPS, Child Protective Service, 4 years to investigate what had happened and come to a determination. And so what this 23-page fax was the CPS report. And it was being turned over to a police department in Washington State, which would then make a determination whether this kid, who at that point was 14, but he had been much younger when what happened, whether he would be prosecuted or not. And my concern, frankly, wasn't so much for the son, but it was for our student, because I knew if her son was prosecuted, then she might relapse, and then the whole family, which had just gotten put together again and reunited, and would fall apart. And I didn't want that to happen. So at that time, there were three women in my life that I immediately thought of. One was an employee of the Department of Corrections who I knew had been raped when she was 12 years old, repeatedly by a family member. And so I called her. And I'm expecting, she wasn't particularly militant feminist and like the other two women that I'll tell you about were, but she's certainly pro women, and I was expecting vitriol and anger, like, this kid did what, you know? And what I got was the exact opposite. So she's the first thing out of her mouth. I'll never forget. I was on the way to Olympia to testify at some hearing, and she said, "Ari, for him to have known to do that, it had to have happened to him." That was the that I totally didn't expect that reaction. I was really expecting vitriol and anger and sort of females circling the wagon, protective of females and anti-male, and that was a horrible thing, and shoot him at dawn kind of an attitude. And I got the exact opposite from an educated person who, by the way, came from the Catholic diocese and to the Department of Corrections. And so then my next call was to a woman who's a public defender now in Snohomish County. And she had been on our original board of directors, and Kelly is militant. I always tease people like she's probably got two Uzi machine guns in her purse, and she's just a firebrand and a fighter for social justice. And I really expected vitriol and anger from her. And she said to me the exact same thing that the first woman I had called. It was like, for that to happen to him, for him to know to do that, it had to have happened to him. And trying to shorten this, the third call was to a woman who also was on our board of directors, was a public defender. She's now in Atlanta. And she has children. And so I'm expecting the same thing. And I got from her what I got from Kelly and Joan, which was like, it had to have happened to him. And so that, like, that 1 hour drive to Olympia, I learned more than I've learned in many, many years about a lot of things. And so that's when I started thinking about learned behavior. And you know, we went from there to being asked to take over a transition house. Interaction Transition got into huge financial trouble with Home Street Bank and a transition house that housed 28 men and women, all of whom were on probation for sex crimes, was going to be foreclosed, and those people were going to be on the streets. And we took that over, and so then we were deeply involved on a day-in and day-out basis with 28 men and women who committed sex crimes. And the long and the short of it is, in all of the years of the post-prison education program, almost 15 years, I've met one person who claimed that learned behavior wasn't part of what she did. So there's a mom who lived in that transition house, had raped her 9-year-old son. And we met her when she was on probation with the Department of Corrections. And she told me that she went to her son and recalled verbally that when she had raped him, and asked her son, "Do you remember this?" And she told me that her son told her yes, and it was like the scariest, worst moment of his life, and that he would never forget it. And she got up and took herself to the police department, turned herself in. But she insisted that nothing had ever happened to her earlier in life. So, and I don't know if it wasn't psychological denial, and I tend to think it was, but all the other histories we know, and it's pretty much like we have a student who was running and gunning, I guess you could say, 24, 25 years ago, and the state took her son away, and he went into foster care. And what seems to me to happen in foster care is you get raped and sexually assaulted and abused. And that happened to the student's son, and then he grew up repeatedly. And then he grew up and did to somebody what had been done to him. So I fervently pretty much believe that sex crimes come out of learned behavior, and that you just going through the process of young life, you, when that happens, you come to believe that that's what people who love and trust each other do to each other, because that's what you, all you've known in your life. And then you grow up and you do it to somebody, and then you end up in jail and prison. So take that for whatever it's worth. We've got a lot of experience and a lot of history, and our population pretty much matches the Department of Corrections. We've never violated the policy that the feds asked us to develop. We don't look and say, okay, this person committed murder, we'll work with him or her. This person has a sex crime, we won't work with them. This person has a property crime. You know, we don't do that. And so I want to switch over and tell you about the first case where we were heavily involved with court. I have a close friend and a neighbor, and we're currently involved in a case with her right now. And several years ago, she wrote to me an email, and there was a young kid out. For those who don't know, McNeil Island has a prison on it. And it's under DSHS, and it's called the Special Commitment Center. And so people with sex crimes can be put out on this island for life. And this young guy was out on McNeil, and this defense attorney that reached out to me wanted us to get involved. And would we support him if she could get him released from McNeil? And I just to show you, the whole show's going to end up being about this, and I'm not even going to get to talk about the Gates Foundation, which really, can I say, pissed off? Good, that pisses me off. So, this is what transpired. So, this was a young, I don't think race has anything to do with it, but a young man, and his experience with sex crimes, I'm going to tell you. Just to show you how ridiculous Bob Ferguson's attorney general's office is and how wrong-headed his assistant attorney generals are and how egregiously horrible things can play out, I'm going to tell you this kid's story. So at age 12, this young man's mom has drug and alcohol and addiction and mental health issues. So she's about as stable. My second ex-wife's dad used to say my second ex-wife was about as stable as a fart in a windstorm. Can I say that, Mike? Good. And that's about how stable this kid's mom was. So at 12 years old, I mean, Catherine and I were talking about this the other day, and I asked her if she – I think everybody goes through – your young kids and little boys are curious about girls, and girls are curious about boys. And as you get into this, you show me yours, I'll show you mine kind of a thing. And in that kind of a scenario, this young man ended up with a group of young kids. And out of that, and he was 12 years old, and out of that, there was a dare that he won. So he could claim the dare or whatever. And he dared this little girl who was part of this group of children to put his penis in her mouth, right? 12-year-old kids. These are just kids. In my mind, it's just like I remember Elyria, Ohio, next to my cousin's house in the basement, next door. It's just kids' curiosity. 12-year-old kid. Everything's consensual, nothing's forced, And he wins this dare, and that was the dare, you know, that she, this little girl, put his penis in her mouth, and she did. The mom, the unstable mom, finds out about it and goes berserk, and she reports her son to CPS. And he ended up locked up for 4 years, from 12 to 16. And then he's free for a couple years. And at about 18, he goes basically next door and he steals a woman's panties. I mean, it's... and he takes the panties home and he uses them for a masturbation fantasy or whatever. No contact with anybody. And it reminded me, when I was at the University of Florida back in the 1700s, we used to have panty raids. And guys would break into the girls' dorms. It was the first couple of years where there were co-ed dorms, and guys would break into the girls' dorms, and maybe the guys were on the sixth floor and the gals were on the seventh floor. You'd go up to their floor and you'd steal their panties, and then you'd hang them all over campus. And then that night, everybody get together and have keg parties and get drunk and laugh. And it was, nobody gave a damn, right? And it was just, but this kid stole this woman's panties and used them as a masturbation fantasy. And again, the mom found out about it and went wild. And this time he's an adult, he's 18, and charges are brought. And he ends up, with my lawyer friend calls, the worst public defender in the history of the world. And this guy talks this young kid into pleading as a sexually violent predator, right? He stole a woman's panties, no human contact, and he's a sexually violent predator. And he ended up on McNeil Island in the Special Commitment Center. 4 years later, my attorney friend, I invited her to be on the show tonight, but she was in a deposition for a retrial that starts Monday. And we may have a repeat of this next show with Sonia on. And but Sonia became aware of what had happened, and she's not standing for that kind of thing. And so we got involved. We interviewed him out at the Special Commitment Center, and we wrote a letter to the Attorney General's office that if he was released, we would support him with housing and education and everything at our that we could possibly do, we would do. And that letter didn't work, it went nowhere. So they set a trial in Bellingham, and the attorney thought it was going to be a 3-week trial. She's got kids and she lives close to me at Green Lake, and so she's up there in a hotel. The trial went 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, and during the trial, the young man who became a student of ours was asked what he missed most while he was locked up, and he told the court and the jurors pizza and bubble gum. And so when the trial was over, the Attorney General's office was reprimanded, and this young man was freed immediately. And the jurors took up, they felt that what had happened to him was so wrong, they took up a collection. The jurors took up a collection so that the attorney and their social worker could go out and buy this young man pizza and bubble gum, right? So that's how ridiculous the state of Washington can be. And I was talking to this attorney the other day, and I'm not putting her name on the air because I don't want it to trace back to the student. Just the other day, and I was like, we were talking about other couple of cases we've been involved in, and I'm like, why doesn't somebody take this to Bob Ferguson? So I like Bob Ferguson's on my Facebook page when he was a member of local government. I thought he was a pretty cool guy. I was hoping he would run for governor and Inslee would get humiliated and disappear forevermore and just vaporize, evaporate, be gone. And this lawyer was like, he's the problem. Bob Ferguson is the problem. So it's like legislative cowardice. He doesn't want to be seen because he wants to run for governor after Inslee's finished his 67th term in the year 3022. Ferguson wants to be governor, right? And so he's not going to get into the press for doing anything reasonable or logical or moral or just on these sex crime cases. And so he's being a total unmitigated, I think you told me, I'm not sure if you told me I could say this word, a-hole. I think I can't say that word. So, okay, so, all right. Gosh, the SEC needs to go jump along. Anyway, so it's just like, just if we come away from this show with everybody agreeing to just be a little more open-minded on this topic, and ask questions and learn. I'll be glad we had this conversation. So, I want to talk about Gates Foundation for a minute. And by the way, anybody who, if you know, we're our office is in SoTo. We're one block east of the Link Light Rail station. It's easy to get there. There's ample parking, and public transportation is super. And I'm like super wide open to having you come visit the office and discuss this in greater detail. You can email questions to questions@postprisonedu.org. But it's about time, and I think we're 15 years too late doing this, that we have a conversation about people with sex crimes. But switching over to the Gates Foundation, I'll tell you, not many people have my cell phone number, and I'm pretty protective of it. And when it got out of hand a couple of years ago to the point that it was ridiculous, I made my cell phone number be the emergency number for the program, and I got a new number, which when I get a call on my cell phone and it shows the caller, it doesn't show the name of the caller, they're not in my Outlook contact, that's really weird. So some years ago, I'm walking across our old office at the Central Building, and my cell phone's in my hand like everybody. It's like super glued there. I sleep with it. I go to the shower with it. I can't eat dinner with silverware because the phone's glued to my hand. And my phone goes off, and it doesn't show somebody's name. And I almost didn't answer it. And I did answer it, and it was Alan Galston, who at the time, and he may still be, is president of Gates Foundation U.S. Programs. And how he got my number, I don't know, but he got it. And it was a two-hour conversation. Alan is a black guy, and again, president of U.S. Programs for Gates, so he's fairly high up in their hierarchy. He can't tell Bill and Melinda what to do, but he's up there in the stratosphere. And he was calling me because his brother had a felony conviction and had not been able to get a job with I think Comcast or FedEx, right? But and he and Alan had tried to get his employer, the Gates Foundation, to work with him in U.S. programs to develop algorithms that would basically prove to society and large employers like Comcast, FedEx, the high value of prisoners and former prisoners. And his request to Gates Foundation, to say it nicely, fell on deaf ears. Like, his employer was having nothing to do with it. And I'm assuming at his level, you're talking about Bill and Bill the Kid and Melinda, and not Bill the old man. But at whatever level he went to, he wasn't being allowed. And what he wanted me to do was to introduce him to Google. So he knew when he called me that I had, and by the way, a Googler gave me this hoodie that I'm wearing, and on the back it says Google Cloud. And you'll never catch me wearing one that says Microsoft anything. Never, won't happen. But I introduced Alan to the guy that was our main contact at Google at the time in terms of our funding. And they had a discussion about Google helping Gates Foundation's U.S. programs develop algorithms that the Gates Foundation wasn't willing to help the Gates Foundation develop, which I thought was the height of insanity, right? But it shows you where the Gates Foundation thinking is, you know. So I've stayed in touch with him off and on, maybe once, not even once a year, or something will pop up. Doris Buffett, before she devolved into being cognitively impaired, was flying in here for a graduation in 2015. She went into Washington State Penitentiary and Coyote Ridge Corrections Center for graduations in June of 2015, and she was willing, she wanted to stop at the Gates Foundation and have a conversation with Gates, with the foundation, about the importance of post-secondary education for prisoners. But her strict, Doris is like a no-nonsense, don't mince words, super lady. And she was like, don't waste my time. Don't get me an appointment with some clown who can't make a decision. So I called Alan and then put him and Doris in together at a conversation, along with Mitty Beal, Doris's director at the time. And I think Alan knew at that point that regardless of his position as president, right, that he couldn't ever move the Gates Foundation to supporting post-secondary education for adult prisoners. And so the meeting between Doris and Alan or anybody else didn't happen. She flew in from Fredericksburg, Virginia, changed planes at SeaTac, and went on down to Walla Walla and didn't spend a minute at the Gates Foundation. And that's presumably because it would have been a wasted minute. And Alan knew it, and she wasn't going to be wasting time. So that's I think very, very telling. You know, we and it kind of, I mean, I think I've got I'm looking at the clock. We've got 16 minutes, right?
Can you talk about everything?
No, I almost can, and I'm gonna try. So, as close to Gates Foundation got to post-secondary education for adult former prisoners was, there were meetings going on at Ford Foundation in New York. And Doris Buffett personally, and Doris, I mean, the Sunshine Lady Foundation was in Philadelphia but Doris lived in Fredericksburg. That's where she and Warren family home was. And so she didn't just like pop up from Philadelphia to New York to Ford Foundation. She was popping up from Fredericksburg. But she and Mitty Beal, who was her director at the time, were meeting with people like Doug Wood from Ford Foundation and people from Soros and Kellogg Foundation. And there was a fifth foundation in New York at Ford Foundation. And Doris recommended to Doug Wood at Ford Foundation, and Steve Patrick from Gates Foundation was involved. That was the deal. And he, Steve is with Aspen now, but at the time he was with Gates as a senior program manager. And we got four, are we okay? We got 14 minutes. You're grinning. You're like, all right. So anyway, Doris recommended to Steve, who was putting together this PowerPoint that I'll try to hold up for the camera, which was Prison to Post-Secondary Education Initiative. That's how Steve Patrick originally built it. And it was, at the time, it was Open Society Foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Berry Institute of Justice. And later, Kellogg and Ford were heavily involved, the Sunshine Lady Foundation. But Doris recommended to Steve Patrick that he get in touch with me, and he did. And so it was my first venture over to the Versailles Palace, which some people call the Gates Foundation. And I actually had to put a suit on, and I had to put on Johnston & Murphy dress shoes and socks even, and go over to the second largest conference room I've ever been in my life, and met with Steve multiple times, giving them our two cents worth on what this Prison to Post-Secondary Education Initiative should consider, right? And it finally got around to, we're going to be able to do this. It finally got around to four foundations, Ford, Soros, Gates, and Kellogg were going to put up advocacy money, so like for research. Doris Buffett had a policy that it was direct service. You know, you were going to be buying groceries with her money and paying rent. You weren't going to be part of this yak, 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 talk, talk, talk enclave. So the direct service money for the groceries and the rent and so on, that was going to come from Sunshine Lady. And then it got down to who's putting up how much, and what I was told, and I don't know if it's true or not, is a woman who's sort of, she's one of the top 20 rated philanthropists on earth. I've never met her, but she's incredibly smart. Steve Patrick knows her very well. Her name's Hillary Pennington. She was at Gates Foundation at the time. And she, I'm told, got Alan Golston to agree to the almost $1 million that Gates Foundation put into this Prison Post-Secondary Education Initiative. And what I was told by internal Gates people was that Hillary or Alan, that it was clear that if there had been one more dollar asked for than the million or the 999,000 that they got, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have cleared Bill and Melinda or Bill and Melinda or whoever the people are between Alan Golston and the trustees. It wouldn't have cleared them. And so... So at this stage, Hillary Pennington's working with Steve Patrick sort of made this happen. And it ended up being something managed by Vera Institute that states were able to bid on. And it was originally going to be two states. Bernie Warner at the who was head of DOC in Washington, badly botched the Washington State bid. And so two other states got it, and finally a third state was added. And Washington had that to lose, and Bernie Warner lost it, which is another show, but he's an idiot. Thank God he's not in Washington anymore. So he's an a-hole, not an idiot. And so, but anyhow, so Hillary sort of working with Steve Patrick made this happen. But then she went to, now we're in trouble, we got 10 minutes. She went to Ford Foundation. And so at Ford Foundation, the post-prison education program's future, or hopes for a financially solid future, were to do research, because we can get funding for research, right? And then pass that money through to the post-prison education program so it can do what it does and be studied. And then the results be reported to funders and government and have that lead to systemic change that's positive. And so at the time that Hillary went to Ford Foundation from Gates, Doug Wood's division at Ford Foundation, and you're talking the second largest foundation on earth, had a mission statement, which we stole or plagiarized or whatever. And so our version of it is right off of what used to be Doug's website within the Ford Foundation. So that we created, Doris Buffett kicked in $35,000, and we created the Alliance for Fiscal Responsibility, Fairness, and Social Justice, or something like that. And I just call it for short Alliance for Fiscal Responsibility, right? And we adopted Ford Foundation's mission. And so the mission we came up with, the mission of the Alliance for Fiscal Responsibility, is to force positive systemic policy changes and institutional reforms in order to deliver disadvantaged people's access to and success in high-quality higher education. So they had this division at Ford under a guy named Doug Wood, who's incredibly smart, super smart guy, social justice oriented, and that mission that I just read to you was Doug's group's mission, right? Hillary goes from Gates to Ford and becomes Doug's boss, right? And immediately changed the mission of Doug's group of Ford Foundation. So it was so, and killed the mission and made his group be all about kids. And so it, which was just like, I mean, just destroyed it. And you know what's so funny? It's not funny. Hillary Pennington has a blog. And she, a couple of years ago, she, in her blog, she slammed Stanford for doing massive scholarships for privileged kids from privileged families. And she wrote, like, if I was to write, I mean, she wrote what I would have her write, right? Which is like, have scholarships go to disadvantaged people who, you know, don't come from privileged families. It was like the blog post of the century, as far as I was concerned. But it was all like a ruse or a lie, because she killed all of Doug Wood's work that was promulgating and advancing what she was blogging needed to happen, and criticizing Stanford for not doing. So with what she did, so she got to Ford and she literally destroyed Ford Foundation doing moving post-secondary education forward for adult former prisoners. And literally, I mean, I've got an email in my inbox. It's our archive email, which I'm famous for. I just don't delete email if it's got any chance of being important. And I've got an email from Steve Patrick that just talks about Doug's wasn't allowed by Hillary to do what he used to do. She went from Gates Foundation, where she sort of made this prison to post-secondary education initiative happen, came up with the first $1 million or consequential amount of the initial money. And then she goes to Ford Foundation and she just absolutely obliterates it. So that's my Hillary Pennington
rant.
You know, Gates Foundation, you know, rant. And, you know, you two, for the next, this is the most I've ever talked unendingly, and without you saying a word, Catherine, ever, not a word, not a peep. So, like,
but I like hearing from you. You have a lot of interesting stories that I clearly can't say.
Well, talk about any of this. You know, do you want to go back and talk about people with history of sex?
I mean, one thing that I remember Ari mentioning that was really interesting was the fact that most people that are in prison for sex crimes are youth. Like you mentioned, right? Is that correct? They're youth. That's
well,
what I read.
I
think that was even on the DOC's website.
Well, I mean, there's no, I didn't say that. And there's a lot.
Maybe not youth, but young adults.
Well, the crime,
it was youth. Yeah.
A lot of the people, where that comes out is people aging out of foster care.
All right.
And land in prison. Like, I was in the Washington State Reformatory in Monroe in the chapel quite a few years ago, and the Black Prisoners Caucus had worked with the Department of Corrections to bring over into the chapel, into this BPC event, all the young men that were locked up there doing life. And there was like 25 or 30 guys that were young doing life in that one prison. But that was a different, subject. But it's just, I think the mic just signaled we're down to 3 minutes, which now we're down to two probably. So we're like, I just think that what is happening with people with sex crimes is wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and I think a good way to wrap this up is winter quarter 2012, we had a student kicked out of the University of Washington classes. We hired lawyers, and 3 days later he was back in, and today he has a master's degree in applied math, but from the University of Washington. But on the way to a meeting, I got on the 44 one morning in Wallingford, and Dolphy Jordan was on there, and this was all in the news. I mean, I had media calling me all night long, Catherine Long from the Seattle Times, 12:30 in the middle of the night, trying to hook up with me for an interview, and the deal was like, Dolphy was like, I don't get it. Somebody can commit murder, a violent first degree murder, premeditated, go do their time in prison, come out and be welcome everywhere. They're not pariah for the rest of their life. But you commit a sex crime and nobody dies. And I'm not belittling sex crimes or murder or selling drugs to kids, any of it. And you're pariah till forever. Just so like the guy that was in our office the other day, you know, for a crime from 25 years ago, he does 11 years, he's been out for 10 years, he's an iron worker, he's a valued member of the community, he's law-abiding, tax-paying, hard-working good dude, and his life is miserable because he still has to register as level 3. So it's a conversation we should have, and I hope people will be open-minded about it. And I'll probably wish that we never did this and that I was right the first 15 years of the program to not have this conversation, but once again I'm proving I'm an idiot or whatever.
All right, so it sounds like a conversation that will be picked up on one of the future shows on the first Thursday of the month,
maybe the next one. All right. She's not at trial.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot to still cover, definitely.
All right, and again, the contact information for post-prison education program is postprisonedu.org. That's the website.
Yep.
Or just contact Ari Khan, right?
Yeah, you can My email is ra.cohn@postprisonedu.org or questions@postprisonedu.org or come visit the office. But just if you come around me on this topic or any topic, be open-minded or you won't be there long.